Rouge. The day was about like the night before, with the kind of icy wind that makes your toes ache and your nose run. Denver pushed through the doors at the police station, stamped the cold out of his feet, and tried to explain that he wanted to turn himself in for a 10-year-old marijuana charge. The police just laughed at him. He hunted down a payphone and called to tell me he wasn't having any luck. "They think I'm crazy, Mr. Rahan," he said with a chuckle. "They think I'm just trying to get arrested so I can have a warm place to sleep. I can't find nobody to take my money under the table or on the top." If I couldn't help Denver get fined or arrested, I figured I'd have to use the good old boy system. I called a fellow I knew, a young mover and shaker in Louisiana who'd grown up playing Hot Wheels with the governor's son. Deborah had taught him in the first grade. I figured he would know someone who'd either arrest Denver or set him free. He did, and just like that, Denver's record was clean. As Denver told me before he headed down to Baton Rouge in the first place, things are different down there. And so the way was clear for Denver to get his driver's license. That meant passing a written test. No big deal for someone who can read, but unable to study the Department of Public Safety manual on his own, Denver opted instead for tutoring. A couple of fellows at the mission worked with him for weeks until he knew all the questions and most of the answers. When he declared himself ready, I took him down to the DPS. After an oral exam, Denver emerged from the DPS office laughing, raising his hand for a big high five. Next came the driving test. He had driven a tractor and even a couple of cars, but had never parallel parked. I drove my new car, a silver green Infiniti Q45, out to the big parking lot next to the Lake Worth High School football stadium and let him slide into the driver's seat. Then, for a couple of hours, Denver practiced parallel parking between the phone booth and the concession stand before the Lake Worth marching band took over the parking lot and ran us off. Finally, in September 1999, 10 months after his trip to Louisiana to try to get arrested, Denver got his license. The lady who gave Denver his road test said she really liked his Q45 and wondered aloud how much his monthly payments were. He thanked me again and again until I finally had to tell him to quit. He took nothing for granted and declared the license one of a great many blessings God had lately sent his way, Deborah and I among them. In practical terms, Denver's getting his license was a validation. Without one, so many things are out of reach, not only driving, but other things that make a person feel like a person, like just being able to prove who you are. Soon after he got his license, Denver used it to prove more than that. Reagan had finally found a job she was sure she'd love, a cook for Young Life, a Christian youth camp. It was half the pay and twice the hours she worked at the gallery, but it was ministry work, and it was in Colorado, set against the majestic Rockies, where a lot of 25-year-olds feel called to suffer for the Lord. Deborah felt strongly that Reagan shouldn't hover around home, waiting to see how the cancer would progress. We encouraged her to take the job. So she packed her bags and headed west to the Crooked Creek Ranch in Winter Park, Colorado. But at 25, Reagan had more than luggage, having had apartments in both New York and Dallas. Jokingly, I said to Denver one day, "Now that you've got a driver's license, would you like to drive Reagan's things to Colorado?" When I mentioned the route wound through the capital city of Denver, his smile stretched wider than an 8-lane interstate. "I always wanted to see the city I was named after," he said. Now I'd opened my trap and couldn't take it back. So over the next 3 days, we hammered out a plan. I pulled out a road atlas and traced the route to Winter Park with colored marking pins. But Denver couldn't read the words in the atlas. So on plain paper, I drew a rough map with pictures of highway signs and showed him what the one going to Colorado looked like. Denver was thoroughly convinced he could follow a map, and he convinced me as well. So on a brilliant October day, we loaded my nearly new F-350 crew cab pickup with everything Reagan owned, TVs, stereos, clothes, furniture. We set a meeting time for him and Reagan, 6 p.m., the following day at the Safeway grocery store in Winter Park, and after a final one-hour cram session, I sent him on his way, armed with $700 cash, a simple little hand-drawn map with checkpoints, phone numbers to call if he got in trouble, and a $30,000 truck with a free and clear title. As he eased down the driveway, I ran alongside the truck, repeating, 287, 287. If he made the turn onto Highway 287, he'd be on his way to Colorado. If he missed it, he'd wind up in the hinterlands of Oklahoma, where I had tried to convince him humans spoke an entirely different language. I tried to convince myself I knew what I was doing, but the plain facts were that Denver was heading out on a 2,000-mile round trip navigating interstates, back roads, and mountain passes, the highest in Colorado, using a driver's license that arrived in the mail only the week before. What was he thinking? Better yet, what was I thinking? As he pulled away with the money, my truck, and everything Reagan owned, Denver wiped his forehead with the towel that he usually carried, grinning a little semi-grin that I couldn't quite decode. The angel on my right shoulder whispered that it meant, "Thank you, Mr. Ron, for trusting me." The devil on my left cackled, "No, it means adios, sucker."
Chapter 36. I ain't no thief, and I ain't no liar. But Mr. Ron didn't know that. It just didn't make no sense to me why he gonna trust me to take all his daughter's stuff way off yonder to Colorado. Now, I ain't the most intelligent man, but I can figure things out pretty good. So I wasn't worried about getting there. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why a rich white man would give me his 4x4, $700 cash, and all his daughter's possessions, and expect a broke, homeless man that can't read or write to go nearly 1,000 miles to somewhere he ain't never been, deliver the goods, and bring back the truck. It just didn't make no sense. I knowed he was a smart man, that maybe he thinks he knows what he's doing. But being smart don't mean he'll ever see his truck again. That takes faith. I expect I never had no more than $20 or $30 of my own at one time. Except for once, when Mr. Ron slipped me $100. Then he gives me $700 cash and a $30,000 truck full of TVs, furniture, and stereos. I just couldn't let the man down. He drawed me a map, thinking I could read it, and explained the best he could what signs to look for and how to get there. After we finished loading the truck, he pointed me in the general direction of Colorado. Then, when I was pulling out, he kept running by the truck, hollering, 287, 287. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. With all his talking and pointing and hollering, I was real nervous and couldn't remember everything he told me. But I did remember him saying, if I miss 287, I'm going to wind up in Oklahoma. And the way I'm going to know it is, I'd cross a big bridge over a big river and the sign say, Oklahoma, and the river say, Red. And that's exactly what happened. I knowed I had a problem, so I stopped at a gas station and told the fella I was looking for Highway 287 to Colorado. He told me a different way to get there, and I was a little worried about that, 'cause he didn't look too smart. I took out of there again and was driving pretty slow, 'cause I was afraid all Mr. Ron's daughter's stuff gonna blow out the back. I figured he'd rather me getting there late with the goods than on time with an empty truck. Part of the $700 he give me was for a motel room, but I slept in the truck, 'cause ain't nobody ever trusted me before with that much stuff, and wasn't no way in the world I was gonna take a chance on somebody stealing it. Things was going pretty good. The folks in the gas station kept me going in the right direction. Now, when I got into Colorado, I started seeing mountains away off, and I was thinking how pretty they was. But I figured Mr. Ron's daughter's camp must have been around on the other side of them mountains, 'cause for sure ain't nobody gonna drive up over in a truck. The more I kept on driving, the bigger them mountains got. I could see snow on top of them, but I couldn't see where they ended, so I started worrying about how I was gonna get around them. Next thing I knew, I was smack up next to them with the road heading straight up. I stopped at another gas station and asked the lady how I was supposed to get to Winter Park. She looked at me and pointed up the mountain. And when I asked her where is the Crooked Creek Ranch was, she pointed to the top. The road is narrow, she said. Once you head up there, there's no turning round. That caused me and myself to have a little talk. I'm a strong fella, I thought. Ain't no reason to be scared. So I got back in the truck and headed up the mountain real slow. The drive was mighty pretty, the sky spreading out from the mountain blue as a lake, and the trees all red and orange and yellow like they was on fire. About halfway up the mountain, I decided to do me a little sightseeing. So I pulled over to take a look over the edge and see how far I could see. That was a mistake. I couldn't see no bottom. The edge of that road dropped off into the biggest nothing I ever saw in my life. I got back in the truck right quick and squeezed that steering wheel so tight I thought it was going to break off in my hands. And I started pouring sweat even though it was freezing outside. I didn't go no more than about 5 miles an hour the rest of the way. And by the time I got to Winter Park, I had about 100 cars stacked up behind me like a freight train.
Chapter 37. When Denver failed to make the meeting with Reagan, my faith slipped off the mountain. First, I thought of calling the highway patrol to report an accident, but I changed my mind as I imagined the dispatcher breaking into a belly laugh when I told what I had done. Besides, Denver was supposed to have crossed 3 states, and I had no idea where to tell the authorities to look for him. It ate at me that Denver had all my numbers, but that I had not heard from him in 2 days. I remembered how wide his eyes got when I handed over the $700. It must have seemed to him a small fortune. I flashed back to a lecture I'd gotten from Don Schisler about the fate of a buck in the hands of a bum. Maybe the temptation had been too great. Maybe he'd taken the money, the truck, and Reagan's stuff and set up housekeeping in Mexico or Canada. He'd always said he wanted to see Canada. I hated to tell Deborah that Denver was missing, but I knew she could hear, each time Reagan and I touched base on the telephone, that our voices had climbed the octaves from concern to worry to panic. So I went into the bedroom and told her. Her response was vintage Deborah. "Well, why don't you stop worrying and let's start praying for Denver's safety?" I knelt beside the bed, and we held hands and prayed. We'd been like that for only a few minutes when the phone rang. It was Reagan. "He's here." Chapter 38. Late the next day, the doorbell rang, and there stood Denver, wearing the biggest grin I'd ever seen in my life. In the driveway sat the truck, washed, and waxed. We sat down at the kitchen table, and he told the tale of his trip. Finally, he said, "Mr. Ron, you got more faith than any man I ever knowed. Things got a little shaky, but I just couldn't let you down." Then he handed me a ball of wadded-up cash, about $400. "How come there's so much left over?" I asked. "'Cause I slept in the truck the whole time and ate at McDonald's and 7-Eleven. I hadn't expected there would be any money left after expenses. So I said, "You keep it for doing such a good job." "No, sir," he said quietly. "I ain't for hire. I did that to bless you and your family. Money can't buy no blessings." Humbled, I stood there and looked at him, not sure if I'd ever received a more gracious gift in my life. I couldn't let him go away empty-handed, though, so I told him to take it and use it to do some good for someone else. The trip turned out to be life-changing for both of us. For him, having proved he was trustworthy, and for me, having learned to trust. 2 weeks later, I sent Denver to Baton Rouge in a Ryder truck loaded with paintings and sculptures valued at more than $1 million. According to my client there, Denver guarded the contents of that truck like it was the gold in Fort Knox. Chapter 39. Between May and November, it seemed we were ruts in the road between the suburbs and the chemo clinic. Mercifully, surrounding Thanksgiving, Deborah had a 2-week respite from all chemotherapy. We always celebrated that holiday at Rocky Top. On Thanksgiving morning, I rose before daylight to hunt deer. Saw a nice buck, just wasn't in the mood to kill him. Deborah, meanwhile, prepared a grand feast for about 25 friends and family, including Denver, who by this time fell into the latter category. The chemo was working to shrink the tumors, and during the break from it, Deborah had regained a few pounds and a flush of color. Had our guest not known her condition, they wouldn't even have suspected she was ill. By December, the chemotherapy had shrunk the tumors enough to make Deborah a candidate for liver surgery. On December 21st, she had 14 tumors burned off, removed by ablation, and after the 4-hour operation, we had our miracle. "Cancer-free," exclaimed her surgeon, who had scoped her entire body cavity for cancer during the procedure and could find no trace. Deborah burst out laughing and crying at the same time. I nearly burned up myself on spreading the good news. We considered it our Christmas present from God. Chapter 40. Our joy was short-lived. Like an enemy that seemed vanquished but had only been lying in wait, the cancer flanked us. By the end of January, it was back with a vengeance. By March, Deborah's doctors were weighing another liver surgery, but felt it too risky only 3 months after the ablation. More chemo didn't knock the tumors back, but instead seemed to feed them. They rose like an evil regiment, and fighting back was like throwing rocks at an advancing platoon of tanks. By that time, Denver was spreading his wings, tooling around town in a car he called Manna, because he said it fell from heaven. Actually, Alan Davenport gave it to him. He often stopped by to visit, and every time I saw him, it was like going to the bank and clipping bond coupons. I was growing richer, collecting dividends from his wisdom. Seldom was there any idle chit-chat. He always got right to the point, my lesson for the day. One day he stopped by and, as usual, got down to it. He looked straight into my eyes and said, "Mr. Ron, what did God say when he finished making the world and all that is in it?" Knowing Denver wasn't much for trick questions, I gave him a straight answer. He said, "It is good." Denver's face lit up in a smile. Exactly. Launching into a sermon, he assured me that God didn't make cancer because cancer is not good. And he cautioned me not to blame God for something he didn't make. The theology lesson helped for a little while. Spring arrived, and with it the rites of Rocky Top. Ill but determined to enjoy the season, Deborah watched expectantly for the first budding of our bluebonnets, then for the birth of our longhorn calves. She named two of them Freckles and Bubbles, and I didn't roll my eyes. We watched the eagles feast on spawning sand bass and marveled at the savage mid-air battles they sometimes waged over a catch. At night, stars frosted the sky like jewels, and moonlight rippled on the Brazos, fish arcing in the cool glow. The only sound for miles was wind shimmering in the post oaks and the low, lonely whistle of distant trains. Denver went with us to the ranch. I had invited him to the Cowboy Spring Gathering, an annual event where about 200 people camped together at the Rio Vista, our friends Rob and Holly Farrell's ranch, right across the river from Rocky Top. We'd met there for more than 20 years to pitch teepees, ride and rope, enjoy chuckwagon cooking, and read cowboy poetry around campfires. "I heard cowboys don't like black folks," Denver said when I invited him. "You sure you want me to go?" "Of course I want you to go," I said, but I still practically had to rope and drag him. Denver pitched his teepee reluctantly that first night, and the next morning I found him sleeping in the back seat of a car. It wasn't that he minded sleeping outdoors, having done so for decades in downtown Fort Worth, but there weren't many rattlesnakes there. Soon, though, he found his cowboy legs and began feeling comfortable among us all. He didn't ride, but he did want to have his picture taken on a horse so he could show his buddies in the hood. If we had had one, we could have used a forklift to get his 230-pound butt in the saddle. The campfires and camaraderie worked magic on Denver as he began to know what it was like to be accepted and loved by a group of white guys on horseback with ropes in their hands, exactly the kind of people he had feared all his life. Back in Fort Worth, Deborah continued to shed pounds, her skin growing slack on her tiny frame. Still she fought. "Do you know what I'm going to do today?" she asked me brightly one March morning. "I'm going shopping." She felt like her old self, she said. I suspected she just ached to feel normal again, but I didn't say so. She hadn't driven a car in a year. I stood by the window, watched her pull away in her Land Cruiser, and worried the whole time she was gone, burned to follow her, actually, but stayed put. When I heard her purr back into the garage about an hour later, I scrambled outside to help her unload. But there were no packages. Eyes red and swollen, tears streaming down her cheeks, she looked at me, her throat working. "Am I terminal?" she asked finally, seeming to hold the word at a distance like a distasteful science specimen. Terminal is a harsh word when used in the context of death, and not one we'd ever uttered aloud. But according to Webster's, it's also a place people pass through on their way to somewhere else. Deborah knew her somewhere else was heaven. She was just hoping the train was delayed. I scooped a tear off her cheek and tried to slip around her question. "We're all terminal," I said, smiling gently. "None of us makes it out if you're alive." "No, tell me straight up. Am I terminal? Is that what people are saying?" At the mall, she told me she had run into an old college friend who'd heard about the cancer, very sweet and concerned, not meaning to upset Deborah. The friend had said, "I just heard you were terminal." Unwilling to appear shaken, Deborah replied, No one has told me that. Then, fighting to remain calm, she made a dignified escape, only collapsing when she reached the safety of her car. She cried out loud all the way home, she told me. It was the last time she ever left the house alone. In April, doctors performed a second surgery on Deborah's liver and warned that her body couldn't take another such invasion for at least 9 months to a year. Still, the following Sunday, she insisted on going to church, where we met Denver. But during the prayer time before the service, she fell ill and asked me to take her to the home of our friends Scott and Janina Walker. Janina was home recovering from surgery of her own. Maybe they could do each other some good. After church, Denver stopped by the Walkers to visit. He stayed for lunch, then excused himself. I have to go check on Mr. Ballantyne, he said. Curious, Scott asked if he could go too. I had known Mr. Ballantyne when he stayed at the mission, sometime before Deborah and I started serving there. Denver told us he had watched a car screech up to the curb on East Lancaster. The driver shoved an elderly man out of the passenger side door, pitched a beat-up tourister suitcase out behind him, and roared away. Abandoned on the curb, the old man staggered like a drunken sailor on shore leave and fired off a salvo of slurry curses. But to Denver, he also looked scared. At the time, Denver had still been an island, a stone-faced loner who didn't poke about in other people's business, but something, he thinks now maybe it was how helpless the man looked, plucked a string in his heart. Denver walked up to the man and offered to help him get into the mission. In return, the man cursed him and called him a nigger. Denver helped anyway, learning in the process that the fellow's name was Ballantyne, that he was a mean old drunk who'd earned his family's contempt, and that he hated black people. He hated Christians even more, considered them a pack of mewling, insipid hypocrites. That's why, free meal or not, he would rather have starved than endure a chapel sermon. Others might have led him. Instead, for about 2 years, Denver ordered 2 plates of food in the serving line and took one upstairs to Mr. Ballantyne. Foul-tempered, cantankerous, and utterly remorseless, Mr. Ballantyne continued to address his benefactor as nigger. The next year, a hoodlum jumped Mr. Ballantyne outside the mission and demanded his Social Security check. Rather than give in, the old man submitted to a vicious beating that left him a cripple. Unequipped to care for an invalid, Don Schisler had no choice but to find space for Mr. Ballantyne in a government-funding nursing center. There, minimum-wage orderlies tended to the basics, but the truth was Mr. Ballantyne, at 85, found himself hobbled, helpless, and completely alone. Except for Denver. After the old man's relocation, Denver regularly walked the 2 miles through the hood to take Mr. Ballantyne some non-nursing home food or a few cigarettes. One day, Denver asked me to drive him there. In some ways, I wish he hadn't, since the trip stripped off my do-gooder veneer to reveal a squeamish man whose charity at the time had definite limits. When we entered Mr. Ballantyne's room at the nursing home, the smell hit me first, the stench of age, dead skin, and bodily fluids. The old man lay on his bed in a puddle of urine, naked except for a neon-orange ski jacket. His ghostly chicken-bone legs sprawled across a sheet that had once been white but now was dingy gray, streaked with brown and ochre stains. Around him lay strewn trash and trays of half-eaten food, scrambled eggs crusted hard yellow, shriveled meats, petrified sandwiches. On a couple of trays, school lunch-sized milk cartons tipped over, the puddles congealed into stinking clabber. In a single sweeping glance, Denver sized up the room, then me, wobbling and on the verge of vomit. Mr. Ron just came to say hi, he told Mr. Ballantyne. He got to be going now. I bolted, leaving Denver alone to clean up. Mr. Ballantyne in his nasty room. I didn't offer to help, or even to stay and pray. Feeling guilty, but not guilty enough to change, I jumped in my car and wept as I drove away from Mr. Ballantyne, homeless and decrepit, who would stew in his own excrement if not for Denver, and I wept for myself because I didn't have the courage to stay. It was easy for someone like me to serve a few meals, write a few checks, and get my name and picture in the paper for showing up at some glitzy benefit. But Denver served invisibly, loved without fanfare. The tables had turned, and now I feared that it was he who would catch and release me, a person who lacked true compassion, who perhaps wasn't a catch worth keeping. I gained a new and more profound respect for Denver that day, my perception of him changing like puzzle pieces, slowly clicking into place. He wasn't showing off, only sharing with me a secret part of his life. Had his secrets included pitching dice in an alley with a horde of drunken bums, I wouldn't have been put off. But I was shocked that they included not only praying through the night for my wife, but also nursing this man who'd never said thank you and continued to call him nigger. For the first time, it struck me that when Denver said he'd be my friend for life, he meant it, for better or for worse. The hell of it was, Mr. Ballantyne never wanted a friend, especially a black one. But once Denver committed, he stuck. It reminded me of what Jesus told his disciples. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends.
Chapter 41. When Mr. Scott asked me could he go with me to see Mr. Ballantyne after lunch that day, I said yes. But I wondered if he was going to do like Mr. Ron done the first time he saw the man. I was thinking probably not, because I started going down to the nursing home pretty regular to help keep Mr. Ballantyne's room from getting so nasty. When me and Mr. Scott got there that day, he was real nice to Mr. Ballantyne. He told the man his name and talked a little bit about this and that, the weather and what have you. Then he said, Mr. Ballantyne, I'd like to bless you with a few necessities. Is there anything I could bring you? Anything you need? Mr. Ballantyne said what he always said. Yeah, I could use some cigarettes and Ensure. So me and Mr. Scott took off for the drugstore. But when it come time to buy Mr. Ballantyne his blessings, he wanted to get the Ensure, but not the cigarettes. I just don't feel right about it, Denver, he said. It's like I'm helping him kill himself. Well, that made me have to eyeball him. You asked the man how you could bless him, and he told you he wanted two things, cigarettes and Ensure. Now you trying to judge him instead of blessing him by blessing him with only half the things he asked for. You saw the man. Now tell me the truth. How much worse you think he gonna be after smoking? Cigarettes is the only pleasure he got left. Mr. Scott said I had a point. He bought the Ensure and a carton of Mr. Ballantyne's favorite smokes, then headed on home while I delivered the blessings. You ain't gonna believe what happened next. When I went back to Mr. Ballantyne's room, he asked me who paid for the cigarettes, and I told him Mr. Scott. How am I gonna pay him back, he asked me. I said, you don't. Why would that man buy me cigarettes when he doesn't even know me? 'Cause he's a Christian. Well, I still don't understand. And anyway, you know I hate Christians. I didn't say nothing for a minute, just sat there in an old orange plastic chair and watched Mr. Ballantyne lying there in his bed. Then I said to him, "I'm a Christian." I wish you could have seen the look on his face. It didn't take but a minute for him to start apologizing for cussing Christians all the time I'd known him. Then I guess it hit him that while I'd been taking care of him, it was about 3 years by then, he'd still been calling me names. "Denver, I'm sorry for all those times I called you a nigger," he said. "That's okay." Then I took a chance and told Mr. Ballantyne that I'd been taking care of him all that time because I know God loved him. "God's got a special place prepared for you if you just confess your sins and accept the love of Jesus." I ain't gonna kid you. He was skeptical. Same time, though, he said he didn't think I'd lie to him. "But even if you aren't lying," he said, "I've lived too long and sinned too much for God to forgive me." He laid there in that bed and lit up one of Mr. Scott's cigarettes, staring up at the ceiling, smoking and thinking. I just kept quiet. Then all of a sudden, he piped up again. "On the other hand, I'm too damn old for much more sinning. Maybe that'll count for something." Well, Mr. Ballantyne stopped calling me nigger that day. And wasn't too long after that, I wheeled him through the doors at McKinney Bible Church, the same place Mr. Ron and Miss Debbie used to go to church at. We sat together on the back row, and it was the first time Mr. Ballantyne had ever set foot inside a church. He was 85 years old. After the service let out, he looked at me and smiled. "Real nice," he said.
Chapter 42. A little more than a year had passed since Deborah's anxious cell phone call to the sushi restaurant sent our lives careening off course. During the worst of times, doctors professed no hope, and she lay in our bed, curling her emaciated frame like a fetus, vomiting, fighting through searing pain. But the hotter the fires burned, the more beautiful she became to me. She always tried to shift the focus from herself, and when she could walk upright, found the strength to visit and pray for sick friends, particularly those she met in the crypt-like chemo lab. If she believed she was dying, she hadn't told me. Instead, we talked about living, about our dreams for our children, our marriage, our city. She paged through Martha Stewart magazines, cutting out pictures of wedding cakes and flower arrangements for Reagan's and Carson's weddings. Neither was engaged, but we dreamed about it anyway, chatting over coffee, murmuring after lights out about whom they might marry, the grandchildren we would have, the sweet patter of baby feet at Rocky Top at Christmas time. We talked about everything important in living life. But we did not talk about death, for we thought that would be giving quarter to the enemy. The second surgery brought a fresh burst of hope. For the second time in 4 months, doctors pronounced Deborah cancer-free. A month later, we jetted to New York City to fulfill a promise she'd made, to be with Carson on Mother's Day. Deborah still ached from the brutality of the surgery, but we planned on doing all the things we would have done had there been no pain. On Friday, we went to lunch with Carson and my partner, Michael Altman, at Bella Blue, an Italian restaurant. We ordered the house specialty, lobster fra diavolo, and chatted over drinks. But just as the food arrived, Deborah winced sharply and pinned me with a desperate look that said, "Get me out of here." Daphne's apartment was just a few blocks away. I hustled her out of the restaurant, and we walked maybe half a block before Deborah nearly collapsed. Clutching at her belly, she couldn't take another step. As I tried to flag down a cab, terror fell over her face like a cloud blotting out the sun. "Call the doctor," she whispered fiercely. "Something bad is happening." I fumbled out my cell phone and punched wrong numbers in a panic. Finally, I managed to dial right and reached Deborah's oncologist. "Not to worry," he said mildly after hearing that my wife seemed near death on a New York City sidewalk. "I'll see you when you get back on Monday." "Not to worry?" I called a friend, a Texas surgeon, who guessed at the source of the pain, a possible hernia caused by the latest ablation. "Ride it out till Monday," he said. Back in Texas, CAT scans and other tests revealed more cancer in more places. The news strafed us like bullets. "Faith," said Paul the Apostle, "is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." I clung to faith like a ropeless climber to the side of a cliff. Faith that the God who said he loved me would not rip out my heart, steal my wife, my children's mother. Maybe this sounds stupid, arrogant even, but with all the bad press he'd been getting, I felt now might be a good time for God to buff up his reputation with a miracle. And there's no miracle like a good healing. We'd go on Oprah and spread the news. I told him so. Deborah and I would have loved to have done nothing at this point. No chemo, no surgery, no experimental drugs. We knew and believed the scriptures. All things work together for the good of them that love God. Wait upon the Lord. Be still and know that he is God. But I wasn't willing to be still and wait. And I don't think Deborah was either. Chapter 43. Dozens of friends, many of them doctors, scoured the web and medical literature hoping to find a cure. We learned of a brand new chemotherapy drug called CPT-11. The FDA had rushed to approve it after clinical trials showcased its effectiveness against metastasized colorectal cancer. To try it, we traveled 250 miles to the Cancer Therapy and Research Center in San Antonio. I rigged my Suburban so that Deborah could lie on a soft pallet for the whole 500-mile round trip. Her feet facing the tailgate, her head on the pillow-topped console where I could stroke her hair while I drove. I made arrangements for us to stay at the Hyatt Hill Country Resort, hoping a sumptuous suite with a sweeping view of San Antonio's rolling countryside might take the focus off our circumstances. It didn't. Nor did the peppy mariachi band singing through their noses in the hotel courtyard seem the appropriate soundtrack for beating back death. But Deborah had been born in San Antonio, and on our second day there, before her first scheduled treatment, she began to reminisce as I drove out of the hospital parking lot, her head on the console beside me. Daphne and I were the first Rh-positive twins born in the Nix Hospital with an Rh-negative mother. "We both had to have blood transfusions," she said to the ceiling. "That was risky back then. Now I'm back again for another risky treatment." Tears welled in her eyes then. "I don't want to die here." "You're not going to die here," I said, smoothing her hair, but the truth was that the specter of death had begun to gnaw at the edges of my hope. The next day we found the rat-infested second-story apartment on Fabulous Drive that we had shared for 3 weeks in 1970. We had moved there for a job I'd accepted, selling stocks via cold calls on straight commission, lured by $100,000 in potential annual salary. I did receive one paycheck before the company went broke, for $13.87. Deborah and I ate 13-cent bean rolls for 3 weeks until the money ran out, and we hightailed it back to Fort Worth. Now, 30 years later, we had returned, hoping the second gamble in San Antonio would pay off better than the first. It didn't. For Deborah, CPT 11 was a disaster. A veteran of scores of chemotherapy treatments as soon as this one invaded her veins. Deborah's eyes locked onto mine. "Please tell them to stop," she cried. The nurses quickly reduced the flow, but burning cramps still rolled through her guts. Still, we kept up the treatments for weeks. The CPT 11 treatments ravaged Deborah, stripping her down to a gaunt and hollow-eyed waif. During this time, I would often see Denver sitting outside our home in prayer. On July 14, 2000, we celebrated her 55th birthday. At the end of that month, Carson flew out from New York and drove with us to Colorado to visit Reagan at Crooked Creek Ranch. Deborah lying in the rear seat, which we'd converted into a bed, but the trip was cut short when the altitude began literally to suffocate Deborah. The chemo had so depleted her red blood cell count that her heart had to race to pump oxygenated blood. We rushed her down the mountain at hair-raising speeds, dodging deer and rabbits on the way to the hospital. We were able to return to Crooked Creek, but only so long as Deborah remained tethered to an oxygen bottle. After we returned to Texas, she caught me off guard one day. "I've called Pastor Ken," she said, "and asked him to come over to discuss my memorial service." On the Saturday before Labor Day, Reagan realized it was time to come home. She called Carson, who hopped the next flight from New York to Colorado, helped her pack, and drove her to Fort Worth. I, too, sensed time was growing short, like shadows nearing noon. Dr. Center, Deborah's first surgeon, confirmed my suspicions on October 8th. Deborah's condition had deteriorated to critical, and I rushed her to the hospital. She had begged me not to take her to the hospital, afraid she would never come out. "I don't want to die there," she said, tears welling. Then she broke down. "I don't want to die at all." After a stint in the ER, the hospital staff admitted Deborah to a private room. Trying to collect myself, I paced the hall outside until I ran into Dr. Center, who asked me if I would come to his office for a personal talk, not as a doctor, but as a friend. "Deborah is very sick," he began. "The last patient I knew of in her condition lived only 3 or 4 days." I wasn't surprised. Deborah's waking hours had dissolved into a blur of writhing agony, but I didn't want to believe him. That death was so near didn't square with our prayers, our faith. "You should start calling family and friends that she would want to see before..." He paused and rearranged his words. "Ron, the clock can't be turned to pack. I'm sorry." He walked me to the door and gave me a hug, something doctors don't do enough of. Then I wandered out of his office down the antiseptic hallway, fumbling with my cell phone as I went. Who to call? Carson, yes, of course, Carson, and Reagan, and Daphne. I walked across the street to a parking lot. I don't know whether cars passed. I got into my car. I closed the door, laid my head on the steering wheel, and wept. At some point, I realized I was screaming.
Chapter 44. Carson called me and told me what the doctors told Mr. Ron. So I went on down to the hospital and stood outside Miss Debbie's door and prayed. Ever now and then, I peeked through the window and I could see folks in there. Carson, Reagan, Miss Mary Ellen, some nurses. I could see Mr. Ron, too, sometimes sitting beside Miss Debbie's bed. a lot of times with his head in his hands. I could tell he was hurting real bad, but there was something else in his face that bothered me some. He was mad, and I knowed who he was mad at. Every once in a while, somebody come out of the room. I'd hug them, and they'd go on home. Got to be around midnight by the time everybody was gone. Pretty soon after that, Mr. Ron come out in the hall, and I asked him if I could talk to him alone. I knowed what he was going through. It was just like when I was standing there watching that house burn down, and my grandmother was in there. I also knowed that if Miss Debbie died, he was going to have to live through it, just like I lived through it with Big Mama, B.B., and Uncle James. There's something I learned when I was homeless. Our limitation is God's opportunity. When you get all the way to the end of your rope and there ain't nothing you can do, that's when God takes over. I remember one time I was hunkered down in the hobo jungle with some folks. We was talking about life, and this fella was talking, said, "People think they're in control, but they ain't. The truth is, that which must befall thee must befall thee, and that which must pass thee by must pass thee by." You'd be surprised what you could learn talking to homeless people. I learned to accept life for what it is. With Miss Debbie, we had done got to the point where we had to leave it up to God. Sometimes to touch us, God touches someone that's close to us. This is what opens our eyes to the fact that there is a higher power than ourselves, whether we call it God or not. You know already Mr. Ron's a talker, but he didn't say a word to me out in that hallway. Just wandered over in a corner and stood there staring down at the floor. I got kind of firm with him. "Mr. Ron, raise your head up and look at me." He snapped his head up like somebody jerked it, and I could see through his eyes that little pieces of his heart was breaking off while he was standing there. "I know you is hurting and questioning God," I told him. "I'm hurting too. And you is probably wondering why a saint like Miss Debbie is in that room suffering when all them street bums she ministered to seem to be getting along just fine. Well, let me tell you something. God calls some good ones like Miss Debbie home so he can accomplish his purposes down here on the earth." Mr. Ron just stared at me. That's when I noticed his eyes was all red and swole up. His throat was just a-working like he was fixing to break down on me. But I went right on anyway, 'cause I felt like if I didn't, he was going to turn his back on God. "I ain't saying God can't use the bums and the addicts to work his will down here. He's God, and he can sure enough do anything he wants. I'm just telling you he sometimes needs to call the good ones home to bring glory to his name. And I can tell you something else. I don't care what no doctor say. Miss Debbie ain't going nowhere till she finished the work here on earth that God gave her to do. You can take that to the bank."
Chapter 45. When I found Denver in the hallway, I was still walking in a stupor. So I didn't remember everything he said, but I did remember his words about Deborah's not dying, that I could take that to the bank. I recall being dimly encouraged that a bank still existed somewhere that would accept deposits of what pitiful little remained of my faith. Back in the room, Carson and Reagan slept fitfully in Naugahyde Hospital recliners. I finessed my way through an obstacle course of IV lines and pulled Deborah close. Soon I could feel her warm tears sliding into the narrow valley between our faces. "Ronnie," I don't want to die, she said, whispering so the children couldn't hear. Grief crippled my vocal cords, and for a full minute I couldn't speak. When I did, all I could say was, I don't want you to die either. The next morning, doctors suggested a last-ditch colonoscopy. In her frail condition, the risk included death, but we agreed to keep walking through every open door until all were locked and impassable. Mary Ellen was there. The medical staff prepped Deborah and took her away. Hours later, we saw surgical technicians wheel her into recovery and raced to join her. The surgeons filed in, looking grim, and I wondered bizarrely if they teach appropriate facial decorum in medical school. Back in her room a couple of hours later, a doctor named Redrow came to give us a more thorough summation. Before he could speak, Deborah smiled weakly and greeted him. I'm so hungry. When can I have something to eat? Dr. Redrow looked at her sadly. You can't eat. Deborah smiled again, used to post-surgical protocols. Right, but when can I eat? He gazed at her steadily. You can't. She looked at him, processing words that refused to be processed. You mean I'll never get to eat again? In disbelief, she flashed me a look that begged me to ask him the question differently so that the answer might be different. I knew it wouldn't be. Though I hadn't told her yet, I'd already learned that the tumors, overwhelming and inoperable, had grown inward around her remaining colon, sealing it like a vault. Digestion of anything solid was biologically impossible. Ice chips and small sips of water were all she could have. In measured, quiet tones, Dr. Redrow explained. When he finished, she asked him, How long can I live on ice chips and water? Days. Maybe a couple of weeks. He expressed his sorrow, businesslike, and left just as Alan arrived. The room grew still and quiet. Then Deborah let a question slip into the silence. How do you live the rest of your life in just a few days? Chapter 46. On October 14th, 11 days before our 31st wedding anniversary, we brought Deborah home. As I drove through the warm autumn day, she seemed to notice every detail, the sun's brilliance, the cool breeze on her face, the fiery fall colors just beginning to show. Later that day, we sat in the master bedroom with Reagan and Carson, poring over memory albums that chronicled our family's 31 years. The kids and I had often, over the years, made fun of Deborah as she sat for hours creating those books, stacks of them, painstakingly pasting in treasured photographs. But she hadn't made them for then. She had made them for such a time as this. And by turning their plastic-covered pages, we were able to travel back in time. We laughed at pictures of our wedding. Here, a shot of her grandmother sitting with her legs a little too far apart and her girdle showing. There, a shot of friends toasting with bottles of champagne. 2 weeks after we married, Deborah's father had sent us a bill for the champagne, with a note explaining that he never intended to pay for our friends to get drunk. We paged through hundreds of shots of the kids. Pictures of us holding Reagan for the first time sparked the thousandth retelling of how we'd honk the horn of our 1970 Chevy all the way home from Harris Hospital. And shots of Carson as a tiny baby had Reagan insisting again that she'd gotten to pick him out of several other choices at the Gladney Home Nursery. We thought then that he looked a little bit like a turtle, and we hadn't changed our minds. In the space of a few hours, our kids grew up, and we grew gray through 30 volumes of photos. And we remembered laughing and crying, just the four of us on the big four-poster bed. A couple of days later, Deborah seemed to turn her attention to housekeeping, to final details, not with sadness, but with the joy of a traveler lightening her load before a trip to a place she'd always wanted to go. Deborah began giving away nearly everything she had. On the same big bed, we sat for hours with Reagan and Carson, and Deborah talked about the things she wanted each one to have. I brought her jewelry box, and she laid out all her necklaces, rings, and brooches, told the story behind each piece, then gave it all to Reagan, except for a strand of pearls she gave to Carson, a gift for his future bride. Apart from the cowboy memorabilia we'd gathered from junk stores to decorate the ranch, Deborah never was much of a collector, but she had accumulated a small collection of antique perfume bottles. She loved the colors and shapes and the notion that they'd once held a fragrance whose essence you could still catch if you removed the top. One by one, over 2 days, Deborah summoned her closest friends, told each what they'd meant to her, and gave them one of her treasured bottles. The first one went to Mary Ellen, who'd been with Deborah every day of her illness. Late in the afternoon, on the day she finished giving the bottles away, I walked into the bedroom to find Deborah propped up with several pillows behind her back, smiling cheerfully, somehow expectantly. I sat down beside her. She wore a soft green pajama top, and the edge of the sheet was folded back and smooth across her waist. I marveled she was even dying in pristine fashion. I slipped in under the sheet beside her and snuggled up close, careful to run my hands over the folded edge to brush away the wrinkles. "I want to have a meeting with you and Carson and Reagan," she said. "About what?" "You'll see. Just ask them to come in." Having just slid in, I slid out of the bed again and called the kids. Minutes later, as we all sat on the big bed, Deborah addressed Carson and Reagan with the tone of an affable but busy CEO handling emergency business that couldn't wait. "Your father has been a wonderful husband and father, and I want you to know that I am releasing him to find someone, date, and even marry." Her words triggered actual pain in my body, as though my blood had suddenly turned hot. "No, please," I interrupted. She continued talking to the kids as if I hadn't spoken. "I know it's going to be hard for you, but I'm asking you to honor his decisions and let him be happy again." Carson and Reagan stared at her, open-mouthed and silent. Suddenly, trying to breeze away the heaviness in the room, Deborah smiled broadly. "Of course, you two are also free to marry whomever you choose." Reagan smiled and cracked wise. "Thanks, Mom." The meeting lasted less than 5 minutes, but seemed so much more a final detail than any discussion we'd had to that point. An acknowledgement that though we had journeyed together for more than 30 years, one of us was preparing to step off the path. Carson, then Reagan, crawled higher on the bed and kissed Deborah on the cheek. Then they slipped out, seeming to sense their mother had more to say. They were right. She asked me to help her into the wheelchair the hospice people had parked by the bed. She wanted to go to the garden near the waterfall that architects had designed into the landscape behind our house. She'd rarely been able to enjoy it since we moved in. I pushed her chair near the edge of the shallow reflecting pool and pulled up a lawn chair next to her. Though she'd been in command in the bedroom, she suddenly seemed more subdued. She spoke, but even the soft splash of water spilling into the pool was enough to steal the sound of her voice. I asked her to repeat herself and leaned so close that her lips brushed my ear. "Even her," she said. I knew immediately what she meant. True to her promise of 11 years before, the one she'd made the day after learning of my infidelity, she had never once mentioned the Beverly Hills artist. "No," I said, "I don't want to go there." "Yes," she whispered resolutely, "it was a good thing. A thing that turned out good for us. Look at the last 11 years. If she hadn't happened, our life together would never have been as wonderful as it has been. And now you have my permission to go back to her." I told her I didn't even want to think of those things. I was still praying that God would heal her. I said and added, "I'm still hoping God will take me first." Chapter 47, October 25th. We had prayed to be able to celebrate our 31st anniversary together. Now, watching her cling to life, her breathing hitched and shallow, I wasn't sure she would live to see it. But she did. As daylight peeked through the crack in our bedroom drapes, I whispered in her ear, "Debbie, we woke up." But she could not answer. 5 days earlier, she had fallen silent. So I talked for both of us, read to her from Proverbs 31 about the excellent wife, reminisced about the first time I saw her, walked through memories of our first few dates to football games when I was too frightened to kiss her, and serenaded her with Mac the Knife instead. She lay still on the bed, at less than 80 pounds, barely raising the sheet. I gently slid my arm under her head and touched her face with my fingertips. "Blink if you can hear me," I whispered. She did, and tears trickled like tiny streams. In the afternoon, the hospice doctor came, and after a quick examination called me out of the room to tell me that Deborah would not live through the day. I chose not to believe him. I chose to believe that God would not be so cruel as to take her on our anniversary. The next day would have marked a week of total silence, but Deborah began to stir and moan. That afternoon, the kids and I and Mary Ellen were sitting with her when she suddenly cried out, "Ron, get me some wings." It wasn't a request, but a command. It startled me into laughter. Unable to move for nearly 2 weeks, she now began reaching her hands toward the ceiling, right, left, as if she were climbing a ladder. Fearing she'd yank her IV tubes out, all four of us tried to restrain her, but she struggled mightily, fighting to go up, up. She really was no more than a living skeleton. It was an extraordinary display of strength. Day passed, then a long, thrashing night, as we all stayed with her. "Jesus! Jesus!" Deborah cried as sunlight crept into the room. "Can you see them? They're flying." "What are you seeing?" I asked. "Angels," she said. "There they are." And she would point to one part of the room, then quickly to another. We followed her motions expectantly, hoping to see angels ourselves.